What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and Sandberg Media LLC, I'm David Dalt with Things Not Seen.
And if you know anything about the history of rock and roll, that you know that Pentecostals and holiness people were a huge part of creating rock and roll, specifically from historically Black forms of music and from Pentecostal and holiness communities, Black and white. That's where we get rock and roll.
Things Not Seen is made possible in part through the generosity of our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/notseenradio. That's patreon.com/notseenradio. Thank you.
Listen closely. As a master painter carefully brushes Benjamin Moore Regal Select down the seam of the wall. It's like poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
Welcome to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. I am so delighted today to welcome to the show Dr. Leah Payne. She is Associate Professor of American Religious History at Portland Seminary. She's also a 2022-2023 Public Fellow at the Public Religion Research Institute. Her research has been supported by the Louisville Institute and the Wabash Center for Teaching in Theology and Religion. Her first book was called Gender and Pentecostal Revivalism, Making a Female Ministry in the Early 20th Century. It won an award in 2016 from NUMA, the Journal of the Society for Pentecostal Studies. Dr. Payne's work analyzing religion, politics, and popular culture has appeared in publications such as The Washington Post, NBC News, Religion News Service, and Christianity Today. She is co-host of one of my favorite podcasts, Weird Religion. It's a podcast about religion and popular culture. And recently, she also launched another podcast, Rock That Doesn't Roll, a podcast about Christian rock. Today, we're going to be talking about her recent book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music. Professor Leah Payne, welcome to Things Not Seen.
Oh, thank you, Dr. David Dalt. It is my joy, honor, privilege to be here with you today.
So I'm going to start our conversation. First of all, I love the book. Just love the book.
And thank you.
I work on material culture in my own scholarship, and this is such a great example of material culture studies because you're looking at the concrete things that people have been doing with their buying habits, with their aesthetic habits, how they think about visual things like music videos, how they think about the music that they pick up in the store, how all that really, you just did this masterfully in weaving it all together and making this so clear and plain for your readers. I know that my listeners are going to love it, but I want to start our conversation in a kind of an odd place.
Okay. Oh, good.
I would like for you to introduce me and my listeners to Becky. Who is Becky?
Excellent.
And why should we be talking about Becky in the context of contemporary Christian music?
Oh, this is wonderful. Becky is the boss, the matriarch, the queen of all things contemporary Christian music. Becky is a marketing persona, a composite figure created by digital marketers as the digital age ascended in the late 90s, early 2000s. But she was really in process prior to that. Becky is the core customer of the primary distribution network of contemporary Christian music, which was a thing called a Christian bookstore. And Christian bookstores were mostly suburban evangelical outlets owned by people a lot of times either they were owned by denominations or by individual owners who belonged to white evangelical denominations and parachurch organizations. And the core customer of the Christian bookstore was a suburban mom, middle class, usually educated white evangelical mom named Becky. And as digital tools got better, Becky became more and more defined. Marketers knew with pretty good accuracy how many times she'd been married, how many children she had, where she liked to go out to eat for dinner, and certainly the kind of music that she would want her adolescents listening to. So you can't understand contemporary Christian music if you don't understand Becky. And I love that that's the name. There are some other reports of the name Lisa, but you get the idea. It's a name that's attached to a certain stereotypical form of white evangelical women.
And I want to make sure that my listeners and I have heard this correctly. So Becky, as a flesh and blood human being, doesn't exist, but rather Becky was a composite of the demographics, the buying habits, the algorithm, if you will, of the typical buyer. And they, if I'm understanding correctly, the marketers at contemporary Christian music retailers and Christian bookstores understood that if they could find the sweet spot to please this algorithm, to make this algorithm light up and sing, they would really maximize their bottom line. Now, I want to make sure, have I understood that correctly, or would you say it in a different way?
No, that's 100%. I mean, the thing is there were probably many real life Beckys. But yes, the concept of Becky is that she is a composite figure who's meant to be a stand-in for the type of people who would be purchasing contemporary Christian music. And for a lot of contemporary Christian music's history, that intuition or that research-based idea of that figure proved to be super profitable. So I think as a whole, marketers were correct that if they could create music that would connect with these women, they could grow an industry. And they did.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Leah Payne. She's Associate Professor of American Religious History at Portland Seminary. She is also the host of one of my favorite podcasts, Weird Religion, and she recently launched a second podcast called Rock That Doesn't Roll, which is a podcast about Christian rock. Today, we're talking about her recent book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music. Well, one of the reasons why I wanted to start with Becky, this algorithm, is because a lot of what you show us in your book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, is that the creation of what we now call contemporary Christian music and the creation of these material sites of commerce, these Christian bookstores, they were central to the creation of an entire identity, a kind of white Christian identity. It was really a very narrowly cast kind of identity. And there was a lot of gatekeeping involved with this that you talk about in terms of the behavior of the consumers, but also the behavior of the various artists that were involved. And one of the things that really interests me about this figure, the Becky, is that Becky was the tip of the iceberg for this kind of identity gatekeeping. And so I want to ask you, as you were digging into this, what were some of the key facets of the consumer identity that was being reinforced and eventually policed by the marketing and the creation of contemporary Christian music?
I'd have to say that for anybody who's familiar with contemporary Christian music, if they grew up in that culture, which, by the way, is not a small amount of people, very large group of, if you were evangelical and white in the United States, anywhere from the late 1970s to the early aughts, there's a good chance that you're very familiar and have a lot of personal experience with this music. So I think that most people who have experience with it will resonate with this when I say that contemporary Christian music was a part of a suite of evangelical mass media efforts that aimed to catechize, to make them, and I'm using a really technical word here, but to raise young evangelical Christians according to really specific guidelines as laid out by certain really influential evangelical mass media makers, people like Billy Graham, who had in his preaching ministry had really specific ideas about ideal American households, two-parent household, nuclear family, had a lot of ideas about the family upholding American democracy and stuff like that. I think another key figure to have in the back of your mind is a man named James Dobson, a Nazarene psychologist who essentially secularized holiness codes, these ways of living, strict ascetic guidelines for living that were really, he created like all kinds of forms of mass media aimed at raising children to be ideal citizens. And in Dobson and his organization focused on the family, and then he also had an activist, like a political activist organization. He was really concerned with creating young people who were straight, who were abstinent, who did not use drugs, who were not confused in any sort of way about what their identity ought to be. And so I think it's really fascinating that Dobson, who was a Nazarene, who had these kind of really strict ideas about how to live out a Christian life, he saw in contemporary Christian music an avenue for promoting that through an exemplar. So the idea is you find a pop or rock singer who in some ways, in all ways, embodies the ideals that you would like to promote, and you hook your work together with that person. So James Dobson's organization, Focus on the Family, and Billy Graham's, and many others, I'm just choosing two of the most powerful ones, they frequently tapped contemporary Christian music artists, serve as examples of the efficacy of that gospel. And it was a really pretty high risk job for a lot of these artists. Very few could maintain that over time. There were some who did, but in many cases, cracks started to show in their embodiment and how they were practicing this form of Christianity. And so what I tried to capture in the book is that ongoing conversation in the music business and about the music business, about what kind of people do evangelicals want to be and how do they want to accomplish that? And there are a wide variety of stories about how that works out over time and what that tells us about evangelicals.
Well, and I'm so glad that you used this phrase catechesis, because that was something from your book that I wanted to ask you about, this idea of catechesis through commerce. And I wonder if you could find this term for our listeners. When we use the word catechesis, it's technical. What does it mean?
Well, in the book, I tried to show how to make Christians Christian, essentially. That's the most, probably the simplest way I could, I think, of the process of catechesis. How do you make a Christian? How do you know when you've done it? And traditional ways of doing that would be you memorize core doctrines of the Christian life. You participate in central rituals that mark the before and after. So, of course, baptism, communion, those types of rituals, that would be traditional ways of accomplishing. Or in the case of American revivalist communities, and a lot of contemporary Christian music comes out of this, you'd participate in a ritual called an altar call, where you go to the front of a church and or any area really, called by a preacher, almost always including beautiful, stirring music. And you mark your transition from sinner to saved. And so there are lots of different ways to say, okay, a Christian has become a Christian. And for late 20th century mass media makers who were evangelical, they were looking around and seeing from the 1950s on, really, that pop music, popular music, had a really critical role to play in the formation of American teens. One of the things that the book traces is really the invention of adolescence as a category and the angst that accompanies this, not just in evangelical circles, but in American society generally. And this kind of unease, like it seems like a wild time of life, your adolescent years, it seems like a lot could go wrong. And so music in the form of rock and roll and then many different forms of rock music or of pop music became this really critical site for identity creation and development. And evangelicals were like, we want in on that, right? So they were really, I think rightly, observed the connection that young Americans were experiencing and how they were expressing that through their buying power. And so it made a lot of sense. They were actually really, I think, really savvy. What I tried to trace is essentially a century of a big experiment to see if you can use mass media to create Christians. Does it work? And I think I still think about it today. It just still turns around in my head today.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to be speaking with Dr. Leah Payne. She is Associate Professor of American Religious History at Portland Seminary. She's also the co-host of Weird Religion, a podcast about religion and popular culture, one of my favorite podcasts, and also Rock That Doesn't Roll, a podcast about Christian rock. Today we're talking about her recent book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music. We'll be back in just a moment.
Things Not Seen is brought to you in part by Liturgical Press. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality. They've evolved to serve the changing needs of the Christian church, and they produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all leaders looking for quality books on faith and culture. Lit Press books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org.
This episode is brought to you by Rockstar Energy Drink. Be honest, are you procrastinating by listening to this podcast? It's okay. You just need Rockstar Focus. Choose from three delicious flavors, each crafted with ingredients for an ideal energy and mental boost, like Lion's Mane, 200 milligrams of caffeine, and zero sugar. Visit rockstarenergy.com to learn more. At least 75 milligrams of caffeine has been shown to help improve attention.
Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. If you're enjoying this conversation, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with Dr. Leah Payne. She's Associate Professor of American Religious History at Portland Seminary. She's also the co-host of Weird Religion, a podcast about religion and popular culture, and also Rock That Doesn't Roll, which is a podcast about Christian rock. Today we're talking about her recent book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music. Well, in your book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, you make this observation. You say that a man by the name of Al Manconi at Media Update, he observed that the persona of the rock star meets three basic teenage needs that ought to be met by God and parents: unlimited time, unconditional acceptance, and understanding and interest. And so, at first, rock and roll was the enemy. But by the time we get to somebody like Al Manconi, rock and roll becomes the model for how parents should be and the church should be relating to these adolescents. I wonder if you could talk to us about the kind of dynamics of that shift and what they were trying to say by saying things like the rock and roll idol is really what we should be going for in our ministry to children.
I love that question so much. And I should say that there's a historian who's done a really incredible job of tracing what I'm about to talk about really quickly, Randall Stevens, in a book called The Devil's Music. But the story of early rock and roll is such a fascinating problem for white evangelical media makers, especially the specific ones who end up going on to make contemporary Christian music, because the people who set the industry's train tracks of what becomes contemporary Christian music come from mostly three different communities: the Southern Baptists and just white Baptists generally, although Southern Baptists are quite large in that, the Holiness Movement, and the Pentecostals. And most of them either come from the American South or the West Coast. And if you know anything about the history of rock and roll, that you know that Pentecostals and holiness people were a huge part of creating rock and roll, specifically from historically Black forms of music and from Pentecostal and Holiness communities, Black and White. That's where we get rock and roll.
You mentioned like Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley coming out of these traditions. Do I have that right?
Exactly. Yes, yes. And Little Richard was influenced by Pentecostalism. And so you have these people who are essentially making music that is the sound of Pentecostalism, but that is not about churchy things. And so in the general like white evangelical or white conservative white Protestant response to rock and roll, Randall Stevens traces how it really became in many cases a proxy conversation to talk about race and racism in the United States because rock and roll was associated with Black culture and Black religion. And for Pentecostal and Holiness people, both Black and white, rock and roll really presented a weird problem because it wasn't that association that was a problem as much as it was the problem that their sacred music was being used for quote unquote secular things. I think the funniest example that I included in the book was Jerry Lee Lewis's Great Balls of Fire, which Great Balls of Fire was a churchy term, a reference to a moment in the scriptures that most Pentecostals are really familiar with when the Spirit of God descends upon the faithful with like tongues of fire, like great balls of fire on the top of their head. And Jerry Lee Lewis uses that song or that phrase as a very thinly veiled reference to sex. And so you can imagine how church people, no matter where they come from, would just be so shocked. So initially, rock has a very fraught relationship with the communities that create contemporary Christian music. And for decades, they try everything they can do to end the power of rock and roll over the American adolescent. They try bands, they try these choral groups that they're throwing everything they can, every weapon in their arsenal musically at these young people. It does not work. They can't cure this disease. They refer to it as a plague. And so eventually, a few really enterprising young Southern Baptist, well, young in their 30s, Southern Baptist pastors, youth pastors, and music ministers basically say, listen, we've got to try something else. So they make up their minds to try and create adaptations of rock and folk. And by the time this was happening is in the 1960s. And so they start trying to create versions of Christian music that nod to the kind of psychedelic music that was popular in the late 1960s without the messaging of that. So they create this thing called Christian youth musicals. It takes off really well in their Baptist youth circles. But what really, really ends up solving the problem of rock and creating an opportunity where they had seen an obstacle is in these young communities of adolescents and young adult people who had converted to charismatic Christianity in hubs around the country, the most famous and the one with the most energy in terms of an arts collective was in Costa Mesa, California, and in the Bay Area in California. So these communities on the West Coast are young people making music for other young people that comes out of their experience and their conversion to Christianity. And that music is called Jesus music. And that movement was called the Jesus Movement. And in that music, very soon after they start generating music, evangelical media makers, people like Billy Graham, see, aha, this is what we've been looking for. This is the solution to the problem of rock, which is not to ban it, but to reappropriate it. And so Billy Graham and others start creating events where these young converts can share their music. And in the book, they're called the hippieized Christians. There's a really great book about this movement by a historian named Larry Eskridge. But these hippieized Christians, they were a small group of people, but they had an outsized influence on general evangelical culture, in part because they were given a platform and access to these conservative networks by people like Graham. And it was so popular that it created an entire industry that continued to grow. And then as generations of people who grew up with that music had children of their own, they had an idea already of how to raise their kids in the faith. And it was through, in part, through pop music. So that's the fraught relationship with rock. But by the time you get to somebody like Al Manconi, they are several years into this project and they're seeing the sales data, which was growing tremendously, and in large part interpreting that as an indication that this is a great way to make and keep young adults Christian.
See, I'm so grateful for that answer because you've really set up a tension that isn't explicitly talked about in your book, but is under the surface. And I'd like to bring it from a simmer to a rolling boil here in our conversation. The Amish don't have a problem with rock and roll. It's easy to keep rock and roll off of the radar of the youth if you are committed to being a small, insulated community that is shut off from the rest of the world. So there's a tension here that you're describing between wanting to keep the youth in a certain set of behavior patterns and wanting raw numbers and growth. And I wonder if you could talk about how that tension has really played out and has, in some cases, played out disastrously as this movement has, let's say, matured over the last 40 years.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. And there were people who I wouldn't say that they're to the degree of the Amish in terms of withdrawing from American culture, but there are, just like American pop culture, but there were holdouts against rock. There still are, who argue and they use very racist analysis of the beat of rock and they attach it to the occult in on the continent of Africa. There's some just really horrific takes on the meaning of rock. And so there are holdout communities who still preach that and teach that, but they are definitely in the minority because on average, I think the project of the white evangelical communities that supported contemporary Christian music was to have an influence on American public life generally. I think the stated goal was never withdrawal. It was to influence the world and to, in fact, enact public policy generally that conformed to evangelical ideas about what was the best way to have a country. So I think that they were never going to be satisfied with withdrawal, that the music was just one part of that effort.
If I may, you talk about this at a couple points in God Gave Rock and Roll to You. You talk about a musician by the name of Carmen, and you also talk about an author by the name of Tim LaHaye, and you tie them both together by saying that they both have a vision that every last square inch of American culture should be rendered safe for children and families. And so exactly what you're saying, if I'm understanding correctly, going into the culture, and this is my word, not yours, sanitizing it for Jesus. Now, when I say it that way, is that too extreme or would you say it in a different way? How do you take that phrase?
No, I think one of the funnest stories that I heard along the way that would illustrate that point was I interviewed the lead singer of Jars of Clay, a man named Dan Hasseltine, and he had so many excellent insights, but he told me a story that is in the book, and it's about how his band, they had a really distinct distribution deal. And so what that meant was Jars of Clay was introduced to contemporary Christian music audiences and then mainstream modern rock audiences around the same time in the 1990s. And so for a while, the band had distinct audiences. They would play with Michael W. Smith, who was like an icon of safe contemporary Christian music. They would open for him. And then the evangelical families would go home, and then late at night, they'd go play at a club, and they'd have this like regular general audience and then an evangelical audience. Well, eventually, they became stars in the evangelical world. And so evangelical audiences would get excited about the idea that their bands were playing in clubs. And he told me the stories in the book about how as a band, they're young, they're in their 20s, they're warming up backstage. And then he just said, my heart would sink when I would hear someone in this club saying, we love Jesus. Yes, we do. We love Jesus. How about you? And because he knew what had happened was that a bunch of youth group kids had somehow come into the club. And not only that, their moms and their youth pastors were there. They wanted that club to be theirs and they wanted it to be safe and sanitary for their children. So I think that concept can't really be overstated. And Carmen was a very bombastic and pretty extreme and gaudy version of that. but most of top-selling contemporary Christian music expressed in general, or at least exemplified, that idea. Now, there were lots of people who were creating music that was Christian, but that did not conform to that, and it didn't tend to chart. That's the thing that I think is fascinating. Back to your first question, Becky's. What do Becky's want? This is what they want. And so for bands that were like Jars of Clay, it was a constant source of tension and frustration for them.
Well, and you say Becky's don't want it, so it didn't tend to chart, but there's another facet of this as well. One of the most poignant examples was Kirk Franklin, who was contemporary Christian music royalty and kept winning awards. And as young African-American men and women were dying at the hands of police, would use the award ceremonies as a moment to speak out and even hold prayers on behalf of the violence that was happening. And these were carefully edited out of the broadcasts, you report.
Right,
of these.
Right.
And so it wasn't simply that the Beckys didn't want it, if I'm understanding, but also contemporary Christian music somewhere in the process edited itself in terms of what it was showing the wider public. Now, am I overplaying this, or have I got those connections correct?
Well, I think that for certain, the broadcasters who broadcast those, it happened twice, actually. It happened at two different versions of that award show. And I think what that shows is that what often gets unspoken, in at least on the radio stations that play this kind of music, is that contemporary Christian music is almost uniformly white. It is a very, very homogenous genre. It's not unlike country music. And so in that regard, they're both based in Nashville, where both of us have lived at certain points in our lives. And so that often goes unstated. And so someone like Kirk Franklin is a rarity in that world. He was a huge star, a huge star in contemporary Christian music. He also had mainstream hits. He is a gospel music icon, and gospel music, for listeners who are not familiar. So if there's contemporary Christian music, which is coded as white, and gospel, black gospel music is almost always coded as black. So Kirk Franklin was one of those people who had an extraordinary, transcendent talent that transcended every genre. And he had a longstanding friendly relationship with the contemporary Christian world. And so I can only imagine personally how painful that must have been for him, as well as just the public conversation that was happening at that time. But yes, the story of contemporary Christian music, I think, is really helpful for understanding many trajectories in evangelicalism. But for sure, it's instructive for showing how markets homogenize in every possible way, how they weed out difference. And when it came to having frank conversations about race and racism in the country, I think that the story that I tried to include in there about Kirk Franklin, but also other artists like Lecrae and Propaganda, who had audiences in contemporary Christian music world, but who kept running up against the anti-Black racist like culture within those evangelical circles, the market just tends to sideline those types of conversations.
I'm so grateful that you've introduced this phrase homogenization into the conversation, because it reminds me not only of the example of Kirk Franklin and Propaganda and Lecrae, but also you talk about Semler, who releases an extended play called Preacher's Kid. And Semler is genderqueer and is definitely pushing against some of the evangelical no-nos. And this sort of shows the ways in which the market changes between the 1980s and the early 2000s. Semler's single goes to the top of the sales charts on Apple, but the radio stations and other sorts of outlets of contemporary Christian music will not even acknowledge that it exists. Now, have I said this right, or would you say it in a different way? What does this tell us about the kind of homogenization?
Yeah, I think one of the most fascinating things about the story of Semler and Semler's success is, I think one of the most interesting things about that story is that Semler chose to have their music sold as Christian music. And that's remarkable, because for quite some time, decades really, the moniker of market niche of Christian was anathema to people who were trying to make pop music. Nobody wanted that term. They didn't want that term because they thought it was uncool. And Semler is a really fascinating figure because Semler wanted to be marketed in that way, wanted to be in that conversation, even though in addition to whiteness and contemporary Christian music, heterosexual relationships inside marriage are the only affirmed relationships in the world of contemporary Christian music. So Semler, having grown up with the music of CCM, was well aware of that. And so what is fascinating to me is that they wanted that label and ascended to the top of the charts. And what that tells me is that the gatekeepers that you talked about before, their roles are in gatekeeping is in disarray in contemporary Christian music and in evangelicalism generally. And I think a lot of that has to do with the rise of the internet and the decline of denominations. And there's just so many things going on there. And to me, what the takeaway was that it almost contemporary Christian music magazine didn't need to cover that because Semler, through technology, has access to an audience that does want what they are creating. And so in the book, I talk about denominational gatekeepers initially are really traditional institutions, denominations, denominational presses, denominational gatherings, and parachurch organizations that complement those denominations, and things like Christian camps and all kinds of Christian music festivals and stuff like that. And almost all of them are either in extraordinary decline or don't exist anymore. In fact, the Christian Booksellers Association, those Christian bookstores that I talked about where Becky's were the target customer, they are a shadow of their former self. They don't really exist in the same way that they did. So what I think the success of Semler proves is that the market itself is a much different place than it was. And the meaning of the market has shifted as well. When I saw that they really wanted to be classified as Christian, I was like, wow, that's a huge shift in and of itself. So thanks for asking me about that. That was one of, there's so many surprising stories that I collected along the way. And that one has surprises in 10 different directions.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Dr. Leah Payne. She is Associate Professor of American Religious History at Portland Seminary. She's also co-host of Weird Religion, a podcast about religion and popular culture, and Rock That Doesn't Roll, a podcast about Christian rock. Today, we're talking about her recent book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and we love our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at IKEA-USA.com/circular. Visit IKEA-USA.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. Each week on our program, we bring you a rich conversation about culture and faith. If you're enjoying these conversations, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with Leah Payne. She is Associate Professor of American Religious History at Portland Seminary. She is also co-host of Weird Religion, a podcast about religion and popular culture, and also Rock That Doesn't Roll, a podcast about Christian rock. Today, we're talking about her excellent recent book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music. In our conversation, we've been talking about identity formation around denominations. We've been talking about gatekeeping, and we've been talking about the algorithms that are used to help drive the bottom line of the Christian Booksellers Association and other sort of facets of contemporary Christian music. Now I really want to focus in on something that you introduced earlier in our conversation, this idea of the altar call. And people like James Dobson began to realize that these concerts where contemporary Christian artists were performing, they could become not just vehicles for a good sort of spiritual and aesthetic moment, but they could also begin to drive calls to action. And some of those calls to action would be like, come to Jesus, like give your life to Christ. Others would be like, donate to various relief organizations and missionary organizations. But also there was this aspect that you mentioned in passing. When Amy Grant talked from the stage about how much she liked Frank Peretti's book, This Present Darkness, Frank Peretti's sales skyrocketed. So as booksellers, as people involved in commerce, they realized that they could get reciprocal effects from one particular concentration, the stage, talking about some other product. Now, when I make this connection, am I being too cynical? Or were they actually behind the scenes thinking about, we can drive the sales of this product if we make sure that Amy Grant is talking about it in this particular venue and vice versa?
Oh, no, that's absolutely right. I think one thing that is clear about these communities is that they are not afraid of the marketplace, that generally speaking, sales and marketing are not seen with any particular danger or seen as being dangerous or seen with any kind of cynicism as a whole. There are always dissenting people, and I try to record those voices when they come up. But so it is not cynical at all or distorting it at all to say that evangelical media makers saw those types of cross-promotional opportunities as a win and eagerly went after them. And if you think about it from their perspective, with the idea that mass media is a vehicle for a particular gospel, it makes sense. They are excited because from their perspective, those types of partnerships are spreading the gospel. It's making Christians. That's why I was saying that it's like a multi-generational, 100-year experiment with that. So one of the stories that I thought was super fascinating is a story about those partnerships in the one of the biggest altar call moments of the late 1990s, early 2000s was an altar call to promote sexual purity and abstinence outside of marriage, known as the purity movement. And contemporary Christian music was at the heart of one of the biggest national efforts by a Southern Baptist organization called True Love Waits. They had a big concert at the mall, the U.S. Capitol, and thousands of young people were there, including a young man named Joshua Harris, who was the son of a homeschool curriculum publisher who used to tour with his dad and go to these types of events. And he was so moved by what he saw. He saw these pledges to stay abstinent before marriage. He saw these moving concerts, this big mass media experience. And he thought to himself, I have him directly quoted, I'm probably getting it wrong, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said something like, we made these promises, they have to mean something. So his teenage self was so inspired that he went home and he began writing and he wrote a book which became a huge bestseller called I Kiss Dating Goodbye. And I can't think of a more iconic piece of media that is associated with the purity movement. He's since gone on to denounce the teachings that he promoted at that time. But he let me know that how thrilling it was when one of the biggest pop stars in contemporary Christian music at that time, the Amy Grant of Another Generation, Rebecca St. James, agreed to endorse and promote that because that was a huge part of introducing him as an author. So I would say, no, I think that there are some folks who would look at that with and expect a sort of shame response with the kind of eagerness to engage in the market. But if you think about the idea that these things are seen as a part of communicating the gospel, then you see the logic that goes into it, regardless of whether or not you think that's an appropriate application of the concept of teaching Christianity. But yeah, no, I think they would be, that's not, that you got it.
Well, I want to stay with this because towards the end of your book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, you begin to really draw these lines together and tie them into a bow, because the same evangelical leaders that understood that they could use the spectacle of a rock concert to drive sales of a book began also to understand that they were training up a cadre, a generation of potential political activists and people who could be directed at certain causes and directed at certain political candidates. And you talk about the relationship of this movement to the rise of Donald Trump. And I wonder if you could, for my listeners, tie some of those strands together for us.
Sure. There were a lot of really savvy political activists who saw many years before the rise of Donald Trump in that world an opportunity to shape public policy because of the relationship that contemporary Christian music artists have to their constituents. And you already mentioned that there were a lot of high profile ministry partnerships between organizations like Compassion International, World Vision, where they would partner with contemporary Christian music artists in exchange for the artists using that altar call moment to promote their work. So there had been longstanding, you know, partnerships in that way. And then there were longstanding figures like Michael W. Smith, who has a well-known friendship with the Bush family and has supported both George H.W. and George W. Bush, their presidencies, and have been really active in Republican politics. So I think of support, in some ways, support for Donald Trump is just in keeping with those past partnerships. What I think is different about the support that Donald Trump has received is, first, the types of people who he has welcomed into the fold. So one of the storylines in this book is about how the rise of Pentecostal and charismatic Christianity in the United States and their influence through music, which is profound. Pentecostals have the group that gave you rock and roll is still giving you a lot of really catchy music. And that's just in the Christian world generally. That's not just in conservative activist circles. There have been a huge growth of Pentecostal and charismatic Christians globally. And the way that plays out, though, on the religious right end of things, the kind of energized conservative end of things, is that Pentecostals and charismatics have really ascended in those activist organizations as well. And prior to Donald Trump, charismatic and Pentecostal people had always been seen as a little bit fringe and sometimes a lot of it fringe. And while conservative candidates and presidents, people like Ronald Reagan, had given nods to those folks, there had never been like a roll out the red carpet, we want you in here. The people who were really in there, in the White House, would be the people who most in the general evangelical or in the general media market would think of them as more respectable. People like Billy Graham, he's Baptist. He wears a suit. There's no very little whiff of scandal about him. But Donald Trump saw in the charismatics and Pentecostals, I think, some people who would understand him pretty well. And he invited charismatic and Pentecostal people, specifically celebrities and musicians, to be a part of his campaign, to be like, to enjoy coming to the White House. And so Trump, I think, is distinct. I don't think he personally understands all that much about the American religious landscape, but somebody in his organization understood. And I remember when the person who he calls his personal pastor is a televangelist with a very scandalous history, a woman named Paula White Kane. And I remember people gasped. There was a lot of pearl clutching at the idea that she was going to be a major figure in his administration. And there were a lot of people who said, what a mistake that was, because it was too extreme. But I think she has proven, she has delivered to him a lot of really important relationships. And I think what in those relationships is the ascent of a kind of Christianity that doesn't really need all of the institutional forms that sustained CCM. It can exist without them. And I think that's the world that we live in. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see in the lead up to the 2024 election, I would not be surprised to see a lot of robust support again for Trump from those communities.
So you've mentioned at a couple points that you view this contemporary Christian music movement as a multi-decade, maybe even 100-year experiment in Christian identity formation, if you will, catechesis through commerce. Has the experiment been a success? And what are the metrics of success that we would use to answer that question? Did it work the way that they wanted it to? Or did it create a kind of Frankenstein monster out of all of this?
That's such a great question. And I think about it a lot. I would say, like a lot of things, yes and no. Did it work to sustain institutional community? Nope, not at all. In fact, most of the institutions that viewed CCM as a valuable partner are in very steep decline. Like every other day, I follow a lot of sociologists and political scientists who are always telling me how many fewer Southern Baptist congregations there are this week than last week. So institutionally, by those traditional measures, it was not successful at all. I think there's a lot to be said with a movement, or a set about a movement that is loosely referred to as the ex-evangelical movement, but groups of people who were raised when CCM was at its height and who are disaffiliating from the moniker of evangelical. And I think time will tell if that is a statistically significant group of people. They're very energized and they're having that conversation in public. And I think time will tell, is that a huge chunk of evangelicals who are disaffiliating? I think there's a lot to be said for the idea that even people who would proudly wear the name evangelical, they don't go to church as much as they used to, and they go to much larger churches now instead of medium or small churches. And so the functionality of CCM is no longer required because the big churches, these mega churches, they don't need a traveling band to come and play to them. They already have everything they need right there. They have world-class musicians. They do incredible performances that could go toe-to-toe with most professional musicians in other venues. So I think the project of contemporary Christian music, one way of looking at it is to say that like a lot of markets, it got very big and then it cannibalized itself. Because by doubling down on white suburban evangelical women, they targeted a market that didn't replenish itself. So the United States is growing more demographically diverse. And so creating an entertainment culture that pretty strictly enforces segregated audiences is not a good marketing plan long term. So contemporary Christian music is aging out, essentially. The Beckys are older than what they were. And there are all kinds of efforts within the industry to engage, try and figure out how to engage new audiences. But in terms of the idea of a parallel entertainment universe existing, it didn't work long term. And I haven't even gone into the internet. The internet disrupted this whole thing probably most out of anything, because contemporary Christian music depended on catechizing or raising young children to become evangelicals in a discrete environment. Like you had to protect your children from outside media influences, which sort of implies that you can protect your children from outside media influences. And unless you are a part of a really radical community like the Amish that you brought up earlier, you cannot protect them from the internet. It's just, I'm a parent. That actually stresses me out. I'm sure you stress. Most parents do. Like, there are severe limitations on what parents can protect their children from because of the internet.
Well, it's clear to me in reading this book how much you loved this subject and researching this subject and diving into it. I want to know, from the time you started the project to now with the book out in the world, how has your view of contemporary Christian music changed? Are you more cynical? Are you more hopeful? What is the result of your having done this project on you, Dr. Leah Payne?
Whoa. Wow, that's a big question. Thank you. I think I am a part of the Xennial generation, like in between Millennial, Gen X. But I think probably dispositionally, I'm more on the Gen X side of things, which is a generally cynical generation. That's the whole vibe. I would say, actually, I find most cynical people to be closeted hopeful people. So I think that I certainly haven't grown more cynical. I think I've grown to appreciate the strength of the American marketplace, in the sense that one of the things that the conclusions that I come to toward the end is that attempts to gatekeep are repeatedly upended by changes in the marketplace and changes in technology. And I, in terms of its the way that revelation has formed me, is I think I'm thinking more deeply about how my own life is formed by the marketplace and by changes in technology. Even this conversation that we're having right now, you and I have known each other for a really long time. In the olden days when we met, we would have never been able to have this conversation. We'd have to be in the same place. Like, we can't have it with clarity now and send it out to a lot of people. So the world is changing really rapidly. And I think this is my long-winded way of saying, I think I'm very deeply affected by the consciousness of that fact. Like, we live in a big market-driven world, and even things that people presumed were sacred are changed, sometimes beyond their own recognition, very quickly by the marketplace.
Well, Professor Leah Payne, I enjoyed your book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, so much. It is so well-researched. It is so clear. I learned so much from it. I know that my listeners will learn from it. I am just grateful that you took the time and the love to research and write this book. Thank you for that, but also thank you especially for taking time today to talk about it with me and my listeners.
Oh, thank you, Dr. David Dalt. I am so happy to have connected with you over this. Thank you so much for reading the book. It's truly my honor.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Leah Payne. She is Associate Professor of American Religious History at Portland Seminary. She is the author of Gender and Pentecostal Revivalism, Making a Female Ministry in the Early 20th Century, an award-winning book. She's also the co-host of Weird Religion, a podcast about religion and popular culture, and also the co-host of Rock That Doesn't Roll, a podcast about Christian rock. Today we've been talking about her recent book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music.
Things Not Seen is produced by Sandberg Media, LLC. We're distributed nationally by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Today's show was recorded at the William Adams Studios in beautiful Hyde Park, here on the south side of Chicago, Illinois. Our theme music is composed by Gene Kija. Our show is made possible in part by the generosity of supporters on Patreon. You can find out how to help us create great programs by going to patreon.com/notseenradio. You can follow us on Twitter at notseenradio. Visit us on Facebook and like our page to receive regular updates about the show and find out more about our guests. That's facebook.com/thingsnotseenradio. And you can sign up for the free podcast, listen to old shows, send us an email, and find out more about our guests if you visit us on the web at thingsnotseenradio.com. I'm David Dalt, and we'll be back next week with more conversations about culture and faith. Please join us.